There is a basic question to ask before buying a general's advice book. Why are we listening to this guy? America treats its generals as revered proxies for its ordinary troops, loving them even though the wars they have presided over have been catastrophic. There has been more than $14 trillion in defense spending since 9/11, more than 7,000 U.S. troops dead in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at least several hundred thousand civilians killed, which is a conservative estimate. Throughout these calamities, the generals lied about what was happening, telling Congress and the American public that things were going well when they knew it wasn't true. The breathtaking scale of their deceit was revealed in classified documents that the Washington Post published in an award-winning 2019 series titled A War with the Truth. Their failures have occurred outside the battlefield, too. One of the most venerated generals of recent times is James Mattis, who commanded U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and went on to become President Donald Trump's first war secretary. Before joining the Trump administration, Mattis was on the board of directors of Theranos to provide advice on building elite teams. He received an annual stipend of $150,000 and continued to defend Theranos even after the Wall Street Journal revealed in 2015 that the company's blood testing machines were fraudulent. Testifying in September at the trial of the company's founder, Elizabeth Holmes, Mattis is avidly threw her under the bus, saying that he was disappointed at the level of transparency from Ms. Holmes. A different type of flameout happened to retired General David Petraeus, another famous commander of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, who served as Obama's director of the CIA. Petraeus didn't last long at Langley because he was having an affair with his biographer and shared classified information with her. The tradecraft he employed to covertly communicate with her was amateurish. They used a draft folder in a shared Gmail account, and while in Afghanistan, his military aides were excluded from helicopter trips so that his secret partner could ride along. Petraeus resigned from the CIA and pleaded guilty to mishandling classified information, but he's still respected and has a lucrative partnership at KKR, a private equity firm. One more item from the annals of generals gone bad. There is retired General Michael Flynn, who headed the Defense Intelligence Agency and briefly served as Trump's national security advisor until it was realized that he had deceived Vice President Mike Pence about his contacts with a diplomat. After pleading guilty to lying to the FBI, Flynn became a star of QAnon conspiracy crowd and called for America to have one religion, no prizes for guessing which one. His leap into the world of unhinged is not unique. Retired Brigadier General Donald Bullock, who served 10 tours in Afghanistan and led Special Operations Command Africa, is a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in New Hampshire and has described the state's governor, also a Republican, as a sympathizer. You get the point. Putting aside the conspiracy theories, corporate frauds, and the sharing of classified documents with persons not authorized to receive them, there is little evidence that the experience gained by generals translates into business acumen. In fact, there is evidence that companies with military officers on their boards have worse outcomes than their competitors. It's hard to imagine two cultures more different. In the military, a general can order the court-martial of a subordinate for disobeying orders. In the corporate world, Elon Musk is powerful, but he can't send lazy workers to prison. The skills used to organize a sales team for another round of cold calls are not what you need to lead Delta Force operations in tomorrow and mortal combat. Unless we forget, the U.S. military has a culture of sexual assault and harassment that has resisted decades of reform efforts. McChrystal appears to have the distinction of making more money from his military service than any U.S. general of his generation. According to a recent investigation by the Washington Post, McChrystal has served as a board member or advisor to at least 10 companies since leaving the military. He was paid more than $1 million for serving on the board of just one firm, Navistar International, which also paid $50 million to the government to settle accusations that it fraudulently overcharged the Marine Corps for armored vehicles. McChrystal also drew $70,000 for a single speech at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln and $50,000 for an engagement at California Polytechnic State University. Both are public institutions not known to be awash with funds. The engine of McChrystal's business endeavors is his eponymous McChrystal Group, which has more than 50 employees and provides consulting services to corporate and government clients. While the book Risk is written in the first person, McChrystal has a co-author, Anna Butrico, who is an associate at his firm. References to the firm are scattered throughout the book, and its acknowledgement section gives credit to about a dozen employees who provided ideas and assistance. The book is prominently featured on the website of McChrystal Group. The book is dishonest because it ignores or distorts the risks undertaken by McChrystal that failed. This includes the Tillman episode, but most crucially, the disastrous war strategies in Afghanistan and Iraq. While there are boastful passages about military missions in Iraq that are portrayed as successful, special forces would identify and engage enemy fighters with a stunning speed, McChrystal claims. The abundant errors made there are basically unmentioned. More to the point, the handful of pages about Afghanistan skate past colossal failures in which McChrystal was deeply complicit. Violent raids by forces under his command are described only as creating extraordinary political controversy because they were antithetical to the Afghan culture. Nowhere does McChrystal admit the actual reason for the controversy. U.S. and Afghan forces killed an unconscionable number of civilians, and in some instances, the violence constituted war crimes.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The African Union early February suspended an earlier decision to grant the Israeli apartheid regime an observer seat, as the issue threatened to create an unprecedented rift within the 55-member continental body. Now, many Africans, including intellectuals, openly rejected Israel's admission to the African Union. A leading Pan-Africanist, PLO Lumumba, says the Israeli regime adds no value to this Pan-African organization.
I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU. Unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the attempts by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the African Union through obtaining observer status. Many countries in the continent do not want the Israeli regime to be an observer member of the African Union. There are concerns that the Israeli question is divisive and might divert the African Union from its more pressing challenges. Join us today as our experts give us their incisive analysis on the subject.
African Union stops Israel. The African Union has suspended a debate on whether to withdraw Israel's accreditation, despite growing calls on the bloc to overturn last year's decision to grant the apartheid regime an observer status. Speaking to reporters early February at the end of the two-day summit in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa, Senegalese President Macky Sall, the newly elected AU chairman for 2022, said they discussed the issue thoroughly and agreed to postpone it until the next summit in 2023.
Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairperson of the African Union Commission, granted the Israeli regime the accreditation last July. Now, several member states, particularly Algeria and South Africa, vehemently protested Mahamat's decision, saying they had not been consulted on the move. Here is South African President Cyril Ramaphosa objecting to the unilateral move to grant the Israeli apartheid regime observer status at the African Union.
With regard to the admission of Israel as an observer at the AU, we've expressed our deep concern about that because it's a decision that was taken by the chair of the commission and without consulting the member states. Certainly we were not consulted. We have views because we are concerned about what is happening in Palestine.
To discuss this subject, we contacted Khalid Barakat, a Palestinian writer, journalist, and activist. Welcome to our program today.
Thank you for having me.
We also have with us here today Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, gentlemen, for your time. Now, let's start off with Mr. Barakat. Now, why is the Israeli regime desperate in its attempts to infiltrate the African Union and is even ready to use unorthodox means to achieve its objectives?
Actually, Israel's policies towards Africa is not new, and that is to dominate and be able to influence Africa in favor of U.S. and Israel interests in particular. If we go back to, for example, the 1960s, Ben-Gurion have presented a plan for Charles de Gaulle then in France to stay in Algeria, and if they have to leave, to at least leave some kind of a settler colonialist state in Algeria along the Mediterranean shores. Israel's history with Africa has always been a history of domination and divide and rule, and also to they are a very divisive factor in Africa unity.
Now, Palestinian Prime Minister addressed the African Union early February and said Israel should never be awarded for its violation and for the apartheid policies it imposes on the Palestinian people.
Based on your historic stand and your support for the Palestinian right and the relevant decisions of the United Nations and previous African Union assemblies, we call for the withdrawal and objection of Israeli observer status at the African Union. We believe that granting Israel observer status at the African Union is undeserved reward. This actually a reward that encourages Israel to continue violating international treaties, breaching all agreements with us. With this reward, it gains impunity and accountability. I am confident in your inner wisdom and judgment. The African Union has constantly resisted colonialism and apartheid. It has continued, rejected, and condemned Israeli discriminatory policies and practices. The time is right to condemn Israel for its crimes of persecution and apartheid.
Now, Mr. Osazua, will the attempts by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the African Union weaken the resolve of this continental body in its support of the freedom of Palestine?
Well, Palestine continues to win the legitimacy war, one that can only be achieved through real grassroots solidarity, global solidarity. So, you know, U.S. vetoes at the UN Security Council can try to shield Israel from accountability for its military occupation and war crimes, but they hardly do enough to give Israel the legitimacy that it has long coveted. And it's precisely this factor that explains Israel's keen interest in transferring the battlefield to Africa and other parts of the global South. Another driving force behind Israel's decision to return to Africa is not just about political opportunism and economic exploitation.
The African Union has over the years been unflinching in its commitment to the decolonization and liberation of Palestine. Most members of the African Union object to Israel's illegal occupation, unjust oppression of Palestinians, and annexation of their land. The Israeli regime remains unpopular among the people of Africa, yet there are still attempts to push for Israeli observer status in the African Union. What's the reason behind this push?
Absolutely. It is contradictory. And also, there are powers in the region that is pushing for such thing. We know that this, at the end, is maintaining certain ruling class in Africa and in the region, including the Arab world. We see, for example, that immediately after the signing of the normalization deals between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, and we know that, you know, United Arab Emirates in particular, they have an investment in Africa of over $40 billion. They're trying to utilize this in order to help their new partners and allies, Israel, to also have a presence in Africa. Let's just remember that Israel today have also military bases in Africa. They are, you know, their nuclear submarines is roaming in the Red Sea and the Mediterranean.
While Africa has to face several challenges, from terrorism to the management of military takeovers, the thorny question of granting the Israeli regime observer status now is disrupting African unity and diverting the continental body from its core mandate.
Now, Mr. Osazua, what really drove the chairman of the African Union Commission, Mr. Faki, to unilaterally accept Israeli regime's observer status at the organization without consulting other members?
Yeah, I think we have to look at the neocolonial nature of these states, right? Neocolonialism, as Kwame Nkrumah once said, it seeks to fragment the African continent and weaken African states and institutions. And so, you know, that also prevents African unity and sovereignty. You know, neocolonialism kind of inserts its power to subordinate the aspirations for pan-African consolidation. So, you know, despite the principles or the stated principles of organizations like the Organization for African Unity and its successor, the African Union, they haven't really been able to realize the two most important principles of pan-Africanism, which are political unity and territorial sovereignty.
Well, let's now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall continue our discussion on the Israeli regime's attempts to infiltrate the African Union. Stay with us.
African Union stops Israel.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today. Now, this week we are talking about the recent decision by the African Union to suspend a divisive debate on Israeli regime's observer status. Now, the Israeli regime has previously been accused of being a factor in the destabilization of Africa through sale of weapons to warring factions. A group of UN experts disclosed that the Israeli regime had supplied lethal weapons that have been used to fuel the civil war in South Sudan, which has killed tens of thousands and displaced millions in this poor yet mineral-rich African country. Now, do you think the Israeli regime's infiltration of the African Union will escalate its destabilization activities in the continent?
Israel is absolutely a factor that will only lead to more destabilization of the continent. We know that Israel looks at Africa as a market for weapons. Their sales of weapons have jumped to over 300% in the last 5 years. And so Israel looks at Africa as a strategic depth to it.
The attempt by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the African Union is creating unprecedented division among member states. Is the apartheid Israeli regime pursuing a divide-and-rule tactic in Africa?
Divide-and-rule tactics have been, effective in colonial and neocolonial initiatives throughout history, and so this tactic that Israel is likely pursuing is allowing them to, continue to build or attempt to build relationships with African countries.
Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Lamamra slammed the AU decision to grant Israel an observer status as a double mistake. He warned that it may jeopardize the solidarity that must exist between member states. Future attempts to discuss Israel's observer status threaten the unity of the African Union.
It could possess a great threat to the unity of the Union. It would also create even issues and divisions amongst people and society. It will only weaken the region and the people in the real national independence of Africa. And there are other alternatives. For example, Israel does not like any kind of a strong relationship between Iran and Africa, or China and Africa, or Russia and Africa. And they try to be present there in order to implement U.S. Imperialist policies in the continent.
According to reports, the African Union has formed a six-member committee deliberate on the Israeli question. The committee will include South Africa and Algeria, who opposed Israel's accreditation, as well as Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, who supported it.
South African Foreign Minister says that despite the chair of the AU Commission having powers to accredit observer status, there was need for consultation as the issue remains contentious.
We believe despite the Commission Chair having these powers delegated to him, the matter is of such importance. It's not the first time it's come before the AU, and it was not agreed to previously on two occasions. The situation has not changed. Palestine is not free.
Now, apart from Algeria, South Africa also actively led the campaign to reject attempts by the Israeli apartheid regime to infiltrate the African Union. Now, why is this important for South Africa?
I think it's pretty much for the same reason of Algeria, particularly because it is a country and people that fought apartheid and colonization and racism for hundreds and hundreds of years. South Africa is a very important country in Africa in terms of its economy and its influence, and also its moral influence on issues of justice and liberation. And so this is really important for the people of South Africa, as it is important for nations of the continent at large. But when we look at Algeria history of fighting the French colonization, when we look at South Africa, we see that these are nations that have a rich history of struggle and also a very strong bond to the Palestinian people's struggle and to the liberation movements around the world.
The Israeli apartheid regime became one of a few regimes to have strong relations with apartheid South Africa. These two criminal regimes collaborated in suppressing the masses fighting for freedom. South Africans regularly hold rallies to express solidarity with Palestinians and condemn the Israeli apartheid regime. Here is one such rally attended by Nelson Mandela's grandson, Mandela Mandela.
To continuously witness children in Palestine being shot in the back, being put in prison, it really pains our hearts as fathers, as parents, and also as citizens in the Republic of South Africa that have witnessed such brutalities in our past. And we are here today as a family with my wife, my father-in-law, as well as my mother-in-law, to say that we will not rest until we see a free Palestine in our lifetime. And we will speak against the brutality that is meted out against innocent children and women in Palestine. And that is why we are here united as a family today, to charge forward with what Madiba once said, that our freedom is incomplete until the Palestinians.
We all know very well that the Israeli apartheid regime fully collaborated with the suppressive South African apartheid regime. Now, Mr. Osazua, how has this historical fact impacted on South Africa's opposition to the Israeli regime's observer status at the African Union?
Well, I mean, historically, Israel gave political, economic, and military support to the racist apartheid regime in Azania, South Africa, to further the oppression and exploitation of African people in the country. And the international isolation which Israel now experiences was once experienced by South Africa as a consequence of, you know, parallel efforts to implement, you know, apartheid and culturally separatist ideologies within each state. So as South Africa continues to struggle with the legacies of apartheid, it's very important that they reject these Zionist normalization efforts.
While the Israeli regime desperately attempts to infiltrate the African Union, African lives in the occupied territories do not matter for the Israeli regime.
Ethiopian Jews and other African migrants face constant discrimination and racism in Israel. The daily racism against Africans in Israel is institutional discrimination and at every level. Here is one such scene where an African is being assaulted and insulted by racist Israelis.
Now, our last question to you, Mr. Barakat. How is the Israeli regime marketing itself in Africa, while we can see clearly that it discriminates against Africans?
Israel's interest is to weaken all societies and to utilize everything they can in their power in order to market themselves as a natural state in the region. And so they'll use religion, for example, and they try to utilize Judaism a way to claim that history as if it's Israel history. Well, you know, the Jewish people history in Africa and in the Arab world are part of our history. It's not part of Israel history. Israel has been established since 1948 by colonialist power in order to be a base for imperialist power to, rule the region. And so if Israel cannot do it through arms, they'll do it through economy and through other means of influence.
Well, Palestine is always close to the heart of all Africans because of the painful history of colonialism and resistance shared by both sides.
The racist nature of the Israeli regime is so brazen that even international organizations, which have for long ignored this regime, have now come out openly condemning it. The latest Amnesty International report clearly states that Israel is an apartheid regime.
Amnesty International is here today to call on the authorities of Israel to put an end to the system of apartheid it is maintaining against all Palestinians living under their effective control.
How do the masses in Africa view and relate to the issue of Palestine, a land whose people face the worst form of Israeli apartheid and colonialism?
I believe that the masses in general in Africa understand that Zionism has and continues to work against African liberation. Currently, Jewish Africans from Ethiopia serve as cheap, exploited labor and suffer the most egregious form of racism at the hands of their fellow Jews from Zionist Israel and occupied Palestine. There's also the continuing racist treatment of Black migrants from places like Eritrea, Sudan, and Ethiopia in the settler colony. And we also mentioned Israel's history of supporting the oppression of Africans in South Africa, militarily, you know, economically and politically. So I think Africans understand for the most part that historical context and how Israel continues to carry out oppressive, I guess, policies towards Africans, and also, like the question mentions, towards the Palestinian people.
Now, there have been proposals to hold a referendum to determine a future government of Palestine. Such a referendum should involve all Palestinian people, including Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and their descendants. Mr. Osazua, do you think it's about time for the progressive bloc within the African Union to champion for a single democracy that will empower all original inhabitants of Palestine through a referendum that will also involve all displaced Palestinians?
Yes, I think that would be very beneficial to the struggle of Palestinian people, calling for that type of referendum and a single democracy would be very useful. Ultimately, self-determination for Palestinian people must be, I think, in my opinion, the primary objective, whether they live in occupied Palestine today or they've been displaced. And I think, you know, there are a number of movements that are, you know, working towards that. Maybe the most popular is BDS or the boycott, divestment sanctions.
That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
There are specific criteria for being a revolutionary. As I said, the third criterion is a commitment to independence. Independence is very important. It includes domestic, regional, global, and international independence. We should preserve the independence of the country and the system in all these areas. This means that we should not be deceived in the area of politics. An enemy whose goal is to make governments and nations follow him tries different methods. It is not the case that he always speaks in a threatening tone. Sometimes he flatters you. And sometimes he writes a letter saying that we should go and cooperate with the Americans so that together we can resolve global matters. He speaks to you in this manner, a manner of manipulation. You might be tempted to go and cooperate with a superpower so that you can resolve an international matter. This is how they speak in the discourse of formal and diplomatic correspondence. But this is not the truth of the matter.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The truth of the matter is that he has a plan in mind. He says that you should go and play on the pitch that he has drawn up. And it is the enemy who says how you should play. He says that you should carry out a certain task. Therefore, the ultimate goal for which a plan has been formulated becomes a reality. This is the reason why we did not agree to join the so-called American coalition on regional issues. On Syrian and quasi-Syrian issues, despite the fact that they had repeatedly asked us to do so, they have a plan and they have portrayed certain goals which they hope to attain. Unquestionably, they are willing to benefit from the power, energy, and influence of every country, including the Islamic Republic. If the Islamic Republic is deceived and enters their ballpark, this means that it has filled in their work table. It means that it has completed their plan. This is against independence. Ostensibly, this is not like a situation when a government or a person comes and rules over the country, to the point that we say the independence of the country is gone. However, this approach is against political independence.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
in the limelight.
The Louisiana Senate recently continued the state's long history of racial oppression by voting down Senator Cleo Fields' congressional redistricting map. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ashley K. Shelton, writer. This article is published under the heading, Redistricting Tactics Threaten to Suppress Black Representation in Louisiana. Here's more. The Louisiana Senate recently continued the state's long history of racial oppression by voting down Senator Cleo Fields' congressional redistricting map. What's more, the Louisiana House voted down Representative Randall Gaines' congressional redistricting map. Gaines is a veteran and civil rights attorney who represents one of the area's hardest hit by Hurricane Ida. And Fields is an attorney and former congressman. Gaines and Fields' proposals included two majority-minority districts, electoral districts where the majority of the constituents are people of color, giving them an opportunity to elect candidates of their choice, something black voters in the state advocated for. Since the black population has grown in Louisiana, an additional seat representing this shift is warranted, just and fair. But in Louisiana, as in other parts of the country, map drawers are refusing to create new electoral opportunities for communities of color. What's more, they are actively dismantling black voting power by carving up black communities in some states or packing black communities into fewer districts in other states. These manipulative tactics make it harder for black voters to elect candidates of choice, regardless of turnout or black population growth. Across the state, countless voters expressed the need for legislators to add an additional majority-minority district given that 33% of the state's population is black. Louisiana has six congressional districts, one-third of six is two. Rather than surrendering to the will of the people or the logic of population growth, legislators continue machinations that will silence voters. State Senator Sharon Hewitt suggested she was actually protecting black voters by not creating a second majority-minority district because she didn't think a 51-52% majority black district would turn out to vote, meaning they wouldn't be able to elect a candidate of choice. But many black voters would take 51-52% any day over not having a committed and representative voice. No legislator should be able to unilaterally decide what voters need. Voters should have more influence. In the absence of a process that levels the playing field by allowing voters to select who represents them, legislators have outsized influence. For instance, U.S. current Congressional House delegation sits in several powerful committees. As the second poorest state in the country, Louisianans are not benefiting or growing from this representation. In fact, the U.S. delegation recently voted against the president's infrastructure bill, with the exception of Congressman Troy Carter, who currently holds the only majority black seat. The resistance could have blocked a wonderful opportunity to invest in crumbling infrastructure. This is a risk Americans cannot continue to take. It is clear that any maps with an additional district will never make it out of committee. State leaders will certainly try to amend on the floor, much like they did on the Senate side when State Senator Fields made a powerful and compelling plea for his colleagues to do the right thing. The next step is for a map with only one majority-minority district to go before Governor John Bel Edwards, who can and should veto the map. Edwards should unite with the people of color in his state, particularly since black voters helped propel him into office. For his part, Governor Edwards said he would veto unfair maps. He would be in good company. Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky and Governor Laura Kelly of Kansas vetoed the racially discriminatory maps put forth by legislatures in their states. Their vetoes were overturned, but the willingness to support the people of their state will be reflected in the history books. Moreover, several residents from three Kansas counties sued to block the state's newly passed congressional maps, which conservatives in the state passed in early February. Louisiana has the second largest black population in the country, second only to Mississippi. If the governors of Kansas and Kentucky, who have much smaller black populations, can stand for equity and fairness, Governor Edwards can certainly do the same. There can be no protection without representation. Much of what has happened during redistricting process seems to be heading toward litigation. In what scenario would anyone take less than they deserve? The truth is that immigration is driving population shifts in the United States, and most of the people immigrating to this country are people of color, including black immigrants. Legislators cannot hold communities of color hostage by continually drawing district lines and ignore population growth. As Americans think about redistricting, they should ground it in the broader fight for freedom. As Davanta Lewis, Director of Public Affairs and Outreach for Louisiana Budget Project, noted in his testimony before the House Governmental Affairs Committee, black people have endured decades of trauma. Legislators can help ensure progress by drawing fair maps and allowing voters of color to elect candidates of their choice. To gaslight voters by downplaying their population growth is a continuation of their traumatic history. All people deserve elected officials who will advocate for them. Legislators should not be able to cherry-pick their voters. But unless and until Americans have an equitable process, legislators will continue to thwart the will of the people, especially when the people are black, people of color, or persons living in poverty.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In what seems to be a hefty catch, the Lebanese internal security forces have thwarted a plan by Daesh terrorists to carry out three suicide bombings targeting religious compounds in Beirut's southern suburbs. Interior Minister Bassam al-Maulawi told reporters that had this terrorist plot not been stopped, it would have taken Lebanon to a very dangerous situation.
A Takfiri terrorist group recruited young Palestinian men in Lebanon to carry out major bombing attacks using explosive belts and using explosives which contain rocket missiles.
Lebanon's internal security forces said the instructions for the bomb plot came from a Daesh operative based in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Helwi, who is in touch with extremists in Syria. The terrorist operative was given explosive vests and other weapons to prepare for simultaneous attacks on three religious compounds in the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is reminiscent to a wave of attacks in the Beirut suburbs between 2013 and 2014. The instructions were passed to an undercover internal security forces agent who had successfully managed to infiltrate Daesh networks in Lebanon. Observers see that Daesh has lost initiative in Lebanon, Syria and Iraq and is trying to gain ground.
I think that ISIS is now trying to implement a qualitative operation attack in Lebanon after the death of his leader al-Qurashi in 3 February in Syria, because he lost initiative in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq.
Daesh is seemingly taking advantage of a deep financial crisis in Lebanon to attract recruits, promising them high salaries.
ISIS didn't stop trying to get inside the Lebanese society when he succeeded in to send many young men from Tripoli to Iraq. More than 49 young men have been sent to Iraq. 9 of them have been killed, targeted by the Iraqis just 3 weeks ago. And now the information about a Palestinian cell in the Palestinian camp in Lebanon.
Al-Maulawi uncovered that the ministry and the security apparatus are monitoring the movement of Lebanese leaving the northern city of Tripoli to join the terrorist group and have opened talks with Iraqi authorities on this threat. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Hundreds of Afghan youths and sportsmen rallied against the U.S. in Kabul. The rally is part of massive anti-U.S. sentiments underway in the country over the recent decision by the American president to give some parts of the Afghans' national assets to the victims of the 9/11 attacks. "We want all of our money. Biden is a thief. Death to America." These are the slogans that the protesters chanted as they were holding anti-U.S. placards.
These sportsmen call on the U.S. to reverse its decision and free all of their money. They say freezing Afghanistan's assets has harmed all aspects of the Afghan society.
"We have gathered here on behalf of all Afghan youths and sportsmen to condemn the U.S. president's decision to give half of our frozen assets to Americans. Of course, this decision is crazy and unjust. The U.S.'s move has affected all Afghans' lives. Our athletes and sportsmen are quitting their sports due to economic difficulties."
The angry protesters also say that if the U.S. does not reverse its unjust and immoral decision, their protests will escalate.
"The U.S. considers itself as one of the richest countries, but now it's shamelessly stealing from the poorest people of the world. We call on the U.S. to free all of our frozen assets and stop punishing and torturing Afghans. Our demonstrations will continue until we reach our rights."
Staging in front of the U.N. office in Kabul, the protesters called on the U.N. and World Bank donors not to stay silent against the U.S. operations and stay by Afghans' side.
Afghans were not involved in 9/11 attack. This is crystal clear to the world countries. So why should the U.S. seek revenge from us? In addition, today Afghans are dealing with many economic and health crises. We urge the international community to make the U.S. reconsider its decision and let the flow of aid to our vulnerable people.
Last week, the U.S. president signed an order allowing half of $7 billion in Afghan frozen assets to be given to 9/11 victims. The move has sparked outrage in Afghanistan and was massively denounced. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is an occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fajr International Poetry Festival saw its closing ceremony in Tehran, where the best Persian poetry works of the year were acknowledged and awarded. During the event, participants from Iran and other countries contended in different categories, including classic poetry, modern poetry, and children and young adults.
I won the prize for the best poetry book for children and young adults. My book is titled Silence in the Mother Tongue. I'm so glad that my effort is seen, judged, and acknowledged by top Iranian literary personalities from the jury of the festival.
Certainly, Fajr Poetry Festival is of great significance to me as an Afghan poet. Here, literary experts from Iran, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the world can network and make joint efforts to promote the Persian language.
Iran is known as the land of poets, being home to many world-renowned literary figures over the centuries, including Rumi, Hafez, and Khayyam. Experts here believe Persian poetry has no expiry date, and not only do Iranians still read ancient poems, they're also interested in modern prose and poetry.
Poetry is a beautiful language that speaks the beauty of the world, and such a language always communicates very well with the hearts of human beings. Iranians have long understood the beauty of this language and still listen to it and read it in its every form and genre.
Fajr International Poetry Festival was launched in 2006 as a platform for Persian poets from Iran and other Persian-speaking countries to get together for the elevation of Persian poetry. However, the literary event has grown to encompass non-Persian poets who are interested in Iranian literature.
Poetry holds a special position among Iranians, and you can rarely find an Iranian family that doesn't have a poetry book in their bookshelves. Now, aside from acknowledging Persian literary figures and poets, Fajr Festival seeks to preserve this long-standing culture and introduce it to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime.